Next up on This Week in Law, Zoe Argento joins us. Mike Keyes and Matt Curtis are here as well. And I'm Denise Howell. No, we're not going to recommend a willy-nilly background check for your employees, but we are possibly going to anonymously search for your credit card number. No, we're not going to do that. And I don't think free speech means that we could even say that. Should copyright law protect you from extortion? Oh, and a gaggle of kit foxes all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 388, recorded June 2nd, 2017. Lawyers, guns, and unions. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Betterment, the largest independent online financial advisor. For one low, transparent fee, Betterment gives you personalized advice and invests your money. For a limited time, you can get up to 6 months managed for free. Learn more at betterment.com/twill. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell here, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Welcome back to the show if you're one of our regular viewers or listeners, and welcome to the show if you're not. This is the place where we get together each week to discuss everything interesting and cutting edge at the intersection of law and technology, law specifically. And that covers a whole range of stuff. And we're so excited that you're able to join us and that our wonderful panel of folks is joining us here today, because this stuff is all really important and tends to be complicated. And it's stuff that people want to understand and they know it's important to their lives. However, it's hard to really get it down from the media diet that comes my way elsewhere. So I don't know about you guys, but I really appreciate this opportunity every week to get together with experts in this field and go deeper and ask questions and really probe, you know, how the law is developing and responding to everything that's going on in the technology arena. So that's what we're going to do here today. We've got just a wonderful group of people here to help us get through these issues. Zoe Argento is joining us. She's a lawyer with Littler in Denver, practicing workplace privacy and data security law, as well as unfair competition and trade secrets law. Great to meet you, Zoe.
Great to meet you too, Denise. I've been listening to the show for years, and so I really enjoy the show. I'm always recommending it to people, and so it's a real treat to be on it myself.
It's a real treat to have you. I'm so thank you so much for joining us for the show for years. That's just wonderful to hear. Also have been joining us for the show for quite some time are my two wonderful co-hosts, Mike Keyes, who's a partner at the Dorsey firm in Seattle. Hello, Mike. Great to see you.
Good morning, Denise. Great to see you as always, and great to have Zoe with us today. This is going to be fun.
It is going to be fun. And also joining us, Matt Curtis, who is a law student at Notre Dame. Hello, Matt.
Hi, everybody. Great to be on here again. And I think we've got a good rundown today, so looking forward to it.
I do too. And I love it when we get privacy law specialists on the show, because I think it's really one of those areas of law that touches almost everything else that we do. It certainly touches everything that you do on your mobile device, on your computer, in the online world. So we're just thrilled to have Zoe here to help us get through some very interesting recent developments along those lines. That's where we're going to start on the privacy front. So there's a story that broke this week that I think sort of, we were talking before the show, caught a bunch of us by surprise. I'm assuming if it caught us by surprise, it caught a lot of people by surprise. And that is this notion that Google and others are finding ways to take your online activity and link it to your offline activity. Now, Google says that it is doing this and that its technology enables it to do this in a way that connects up data about its anonymized users and not about you, Dan Coates, or whatever your name may be specifically. What it is doing that broke this week is taking credit card purchases, real world credit card purchases, and providing its advertisers, its clients, its customers, with information that links those purchases back to their advertising strategy with Google. In other words, if you've posted an ad, your furniture store, say, and you want to know if Google users are seeing that ad, clicking on that ad, and then coming into your store and purchasing things, that's what Google says that it's going to be able to deliver to its advertiser customers. It is going about this through its analytics, innovations, and machine learning capabilities, which are growing by leaps and bounds. If you've been paying attention to the world of AI and Go, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And specifically, Google, in addressing its customers, over 1,000 marketers from around the world attending Google Marketing Next. It has a blog post from Sridhar Ramaswamy, its senior vice president of ads and commerce, specifically addressing those people, but of course available for all of us to see what they're up to too. And one of the things they're up to is attempting to deliver to their advertising customers this connection between the ads that they place and the purchases that people may be prompted to make after having been influenced by those ads. One of the things the blog post says, tells these customers of Google's, is that if they're collecting email information at the point of sale for their loyalty programs, they can import store transactions directly into AdWords themselves or through a third-party data provider. But even if their business doesn't have a large loyalty program, they can still measure store sales by taking advantage of Google's third-party partnerships, which capture approximately 70% of credit card and debit card transactions in the United States, as Technology Review wrote about that particular factoid. So if you buy stuff with a card, there's a less than 1 in 3 chance that Google doesn't know about it. So with that information, they go on to tell their customers there's no time-consuming setup or costly integrations required on their end. They also don't need to share any customer information. This is what Google's telling them. After they opt in, they can automatically report on their store sales in AdWords. Both solutions leading back to the customer's collection of email and putting it in manually into AdWords. Both solutions match transactions back to Google Ads in a secure and privacy-safe way and only report on your aggregated and anonymized store sales to protect your customer data. So, Zoe, what do you think about all this?
Yeah, so it's interesting, and as you said, a bit surprising. So, I mean, I think one of my questions in hearing this is trying to understand exactly how it works, you know, because in privacy law, the devil is really in the details about exactly what you're doing. And of course, companies are often loath to give those details in describing exactly what they're doing. So, you know, just reading this description, the way I understand, sorry for all the puffing, let me put this down a little. The way I understand how this is working is that probably, I'm guessing that the third parties that Google is getting the credit card transaction information from are the credit card processors, who often serve as middlemen between the acquiring bank, which is the account, the bank that maintains the merchant's bank account, and the merchant. And I'd imagine that's the case because my impression is that industry is highly consolidated. So Google might just have to partner with a few players to get up to 70% of credit card information. And then I suppose that Google is matching the names of its users, you know, based on profile information for its accounts, with the names on the credit cards. Because I don't think, and I, you know, God knows, you know, Google collects a lot of information, but I don't think that Google is collecting names in a reliable fashion, just generally, unless someone opens an account and, you know, puts that in their profile information in Google, at least in kind of a consistent way, though, of course, please let me know if I'm wrong. So I'm guessing what Google is doing here is that they're tying the names that they have on these user accounts to the names on the credit cards. And so, you know, I think that makes me wonder, you know, how accurate this is. In part, you know, it's probably accurate a good amount of the time, but I know for me personally, the name on my credit card is not the name on my Google account. You know, I try to be tricky and put a different name in. So I guess I would wonder, I guess it's kind of a global question about, you know, exactly how is this working in practice? And then Google says it sets up this kind of double blind encryption process or double blind security process so that the actual information about, you know, the names of the Google's users aren't revealed to the merchants. So they don't know that, you know, Zoe Argento went in and bought, you know, was looking online for, I don't know, a lawnmower and then went into the store and bought a lawnmower. They just know that a certain percentage of people who went and looked at advertisements that they placed went in and bought, you know, a particular product. So I think, you know, that's roughly the way it would work. Sorry, go ahead.
There's a lot to unpack in what you just said, and I want to try and suss some of it out. First of all, you raise a good point that maybe Google doesn't know your name if you don't have a Google account. Now, I don't know how many people who use Google regularly, and certainly if you're using all of it, the rest of its services besides search, you're going to have a Google account, right? You need one for email and YouTube and everything else. So there probably is a subset of people who don't have Google accounts and maybe using Google somewhat anonymously. You raise the idea that perhaps it's possible for them to know the names of users who are using the service just for search and don't have an account. I wonder if it has technology that could figure that out. I wouldn't be terribly surprised to learn that it did, but it's certainly not something that they're going into any detail about here in this blog post as to how they're putting this together. The other thing they would not be going into any detail about here, number one, because it would be proprietary, and number two, because I think it would freak the heck out of people, is exactly what you're speculating about here, Zoe, that they are matching up real world credit card names with real world Google accounts, and that they at least have a database that knows in a very non-anonymized way, if you're right, if you clicked on an ad. Or I wonder if they know, to what extent they know at least that an ad was displayed to you. Because I think that that, again, is something you can parse, that people see ads online and perhaps are influenced by them without ever clicking on them. So I wonder how Google parses that data as well. But in any event, whether they're knowing whether they displayed it to you or you clicked on it, if they are matching up your named identified Google account with a named identified credit card account, I think that would give a lot of people pause, but it's probably a likely way that this is working, as you say. And then the other thing I thought that we should unpack a little bit is people, you know, I think you're in the minority, Zoe, of people who would use a different name on their Google account than on their credit card.
Well, I am maybe a privacy lawyer.
Yes, exactly. but it's not probably not a bad idea. Mike, what were you going to add?
Well, yeah, I found this to be somewhat astonishing. And Zoe, it seems like you're exactly right that this information must be getting obtained from the processors, which, as you alluded to, are the ones that process these transactions. But I'm surprised to hear that processors would be allowed, if that's indeed how they're getting this information, that processors would be allowed to share any information regarding a transaction that you did with your local convenience store or, you know, local furniture store or whatever. What's the situation there? Are processors able to disclose information about your transactions? They must be able to, if that's how this information is getting shared.
Right. So I think it really largely depends on the contractual obligations that the credit card processors have. So kind of the big set of contractual obligations that are pushed down on credit card processors are the payment card industry data security standards. So you may be familiar with these. These are called PCI DSS. And so any merchant basically has to know about this, and it's usually a very painful subject that they hate. So basically, this is a long set of data security standards that anyone who's dealing with credit card information in any way is supposed to comply with. It does not have force. It's not, you know, passed by a statute. It's a set of contracts. So the credit card brands have come up with this, and then they push it down by contract to the acquiring banks, which push it down by contract. You know, they're required in the contract with the credit card brands to push it down to the merchants. And it also gets pushed down to the credit card processors. But nowhere in the payment card industry data security standards does it say that you can't disclose credit card information. It just says that if you do disclose it, you have to make sure that the same kind of contractual obligations are pushed down to the party who's using that information. So I don't know, you know, precisely what's in all the contracts with the credit card processors, and, you know, who knows, there might be some obligations along those lines of non-disclosure, which you know, they may have had to try to figure out and deal with in order to do this deal with Google. But certainly there would be a requirement that, you know, any party that they're sharing this information with apply data security standards. You know, it's just a lot of stuff like having a firewall and, you know, login credentials to your system. So points like that. So I think that from that standpoint, there isn't necessarily a limitation. I think that, I guess I should first say that, you know, I'm not aware of any laws that require the acquiring banks or the merchants or credit card processors to make any sort of privacy promises to consumers about what they're doing with their data. So there's not really a concern on that end about being deceptive. I bring that up because I would be wondering on Google's end about whether what they're planning to do would violate their own privacy policy. As you may very well know, there is this law called, you know, Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, which is the Unfair and Deceptive Trade Practices Law. This is enforced by the FTC, and then they're kind of equivalent laws at the state level. And so if you put out a privacy policy to the public and then you end up, you know, not acting in accordance with what you said you were going to do, then there's a pretty strong claim against you under as a deceptive trade practice. And the FTC is all over that. And so I also bring this up because there was a case on almost exactly this issue, kind of at the dawning dinosaur days of e-commerce. It was called the DoubleClick litigation. And so DoubleClick was the Google of its day, and in fact, really is the Google of its day because Google acquired DoubleClick. and so now DoubleClick is part of Google. But what DoubleClick was doing, it was acting kind of a middleman on advertising. So it would kind of match up advertisers with websites and find, you know, a good website for the particular demographic you were looking for and help kind of facilitate that transaction. In the process of doing that, they collected a ton of data, of course, about consumers and, you know, demographic information, mostly in aggregate. And then in 1999, they acquired the biggest direct marketer of the time, which was Abacus. And so they had all that, you know, address information and name information that direct marketers had. So then DoubleClick indicated that it was going to merge the databases by suddenly changing its privacy policy to indicate that, to delete the statement that said they weren't going to associate that kind of aggregate data with personally identifiable information. So that seemed a pretty clear sign that they were going to merge these two databases. So the Federal Trade Commission at that point freaked out and launched a very intensive investigation into whether DoubleClick was violating Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, I think particularly with a deceptive, maybe an unfair trade practice, but more likely a deceptive trade practice by collecting information under kind of one set of privacy promises and then doing something different with it. And so lo and behold, after a few months of this, the CEO of DoubleClick announced that he had made a mistake and that they weren't going to merge these databases. And so advertisers since then have looked at this, and I always like to think of Ghostbusters and, you know, the important statement for a Ghostbuster, which is don't cross the streams, right? So don't combine the online and offline databases. particularly if you've been making promises that you're not going to do that. So I am sure that Google is very aware of this and has taken a very close look at its privacy policy to make sure it doesn't get in trouble there. But I think this is a concerning point, and I think really the operative question would be, what was the privacy policy in place at the time that data was collected, right? Because I'm not sure that in all cases you can really apply a new privacy policy retrospectively to information that was collected under a different regime. And so even if they could get away with, changing the privacy policy, I wonder about whether there might be grounds for an unfair trade practice, right? So there are kind of two parts of the Federal Trade Commission Act, Section 5. There is the deceptive trade practices, which is saying that you're going to do one thing and then doing something else. And then there's the unfair trade practices, which is a bit more fuzzy. But it's basically, the FTC has its own kind of definition of what they call it. It's basically causing or being likely to cause substantial injury to consumers, which is not reasonably avoidable by consumers themselves and not outweighed by countervailing benefits. So it's a really fuzzy standard. I don't know. I think it's always a bit hard to apply, but maybe there would be some argument along those lines from Google's side. Sorry to keep droning on, but just one other point. I think from the credit card ecosystem point of view, as I said, I don't think that there's really a deceptive trade practice because there really aren't privacy policies, maybe an unfair trade practice. Maybe arguably some sort of privacy claim that, you're giving this information and you're not expecting it to be shared with someone who's going to combine it with all this other information. But I don't think a claim like that is likely to be very successful because there have been cases along those lines, and there's a particularly famous one called Dwyer v. American Express. And this was a case in the 90s. And here the defendant was a credit card company, which was selling information about its credit card holders' spending habits to advertising companies, who then sent the individuals, the plaintiffs, directed mail. And the credit card holders, the people who are getting all this unwanted mail, didn't like the fact that credit card companies were selling that information about them. And so they sued for a number of claims, including kind of an invasion of privacy claim and then a misappropriation of identity claim. And so the court looked at that and said, by using this card and giving this information to the defendants, it's not really private, right? Because you're sharing it. That's kind of a general principle in privacy law that if you share something with someone else, then you lose privacy claims to it normally. The other claim was misappropriation of identity claim. And the argument on the plaintiff's side was, hey, my name has some value. So you may know there's kind of a common law claim in pretty much every state that someone can't use your name and image without your permission for their commercial benefit. And so the plaintiffs argued, you're using my name for commercial benefit without my permission. And the court said, the name itself doesn't really have value here. It's, the spending profile, and that only has value in the aggregate. So it doesn't really fall under this tort. I think there's some room to disagree with that, right? Because, arguably your name and your profile, your kind of spending image does have value. And I think that that's an argument that a lot of privacy advocates have made that, instead of allowing all these companies to make money off of us, maybe we, the consumers, should be selling our information and making money off of it ourselves. So I think it gets down to some of these kind of basic questions about what your rights are and how far privacy extends. So I've talked a lot, so I'll let someone else jump in.
Well, I have a question to follow up on what you've been discussing. Here we're talking about what obligations might be incumbent on the people you're sharing this data with. And I think a lot of people probably have a view of their credit card company as being under similar obligations as a bank. And in some instances, maybe their credit card is issued by their bank, further complicating that relationship. So banks obviously are under very onerous federal regulations to keep customer data secure and private.
whereas credit card companies may not be. And I'm just wondering what you know about what sort of obligations are on those who provide consumer credit.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
I'm sure there are terms and conditions and certainly privacy must be dealt with in there somewhere, but it's one of those, where you're in the situation where somebody's being presented with something they're never going to read. A lot of signing up for consumer credit these days is done in an online way, in an electronic way, where you're, checking out and they offer you a credit card and you say, sure, and they run your credit check and you click a box accepting the terms and you're in. So it is sort of a crossing of the streams. Maybe in elder times, you were presented with documentation that you might glance at and then sign. But more and more, I don't think it happens that way. So even though your credit cards are used both online and offline, it seems like maybe the transaction where you sign up with that company is much like your transaction where you sign up with Google. You're presented with terms that maybe you'll click on and read, but probably not. And off you go.
Yes, I think that's often the case. And, arguably that's kind of the problem with our whole privacy regime in this country anyway. It's kind of as long as you tell people what you're doing, it's a laissez-faire approach, generally speaking, and the idea that we're all grown-ups and we can make our decisions for ourselves. But there's a real problem with that when, it would take you half a year to read the privacy policies of all the websites you use on a regular basis, because they're all, 15 pages long. Right. Notice doesn't work really well in that context.
Yeah. And I have one thing just to add to the discussion here, before we started the show, Matt, you were talking about how, just the notion of, a company, a service that people use and trust like Google, building dossiers on them from offline sources took you by surprise. The since at least 2013, Lifehacker and others, MIT Technology Review among them, have been reporting on Facebook's practices that are similar and how it buys information from third-party data brokers to further fill out its knowledge of its users and then leverage that for advertisers. You haven't chimed in yet in this discussion, Matt. Are you trying to pick yourself up off the floor that all this happens?
Generally, yes. I'm also just taking notes. I think Zoe's providing great information here. So I think that the two things that kind of struck me were, one is that I had no idea that my credit card company, I sort of thought of them, I think Denise was kind of talking about this, as a fiduciary, my credit card company, my bank. And so I just assumed that they wouldn't be allowed to do this. I'm not surprised that Google wants to have this. I do think that their characterization of their data policies as being anonymous, as Zoe was talking about, you have to, if it's in a single vertical where you're getting your data, it could theoretically be anonymous and they could just have a unique number for you where they don't actually know. But if you're buying it from another party, there has to be a connector of that data, whether that's the name or whether that's – I would assume it's the name. But to say that this is anonymous, it may be anonymous for third parties buying the right to advertise you or advertising space to you. But it's not I can't see how it's anonymous internally. This distinction between anonymous and privacy and trying to like find out where the line is alive and well in the discussion of law right now. And if we're using this term when it's not anonymous, that's problematic. So, but mostly I'm just blown away. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's making me want to, pay cash for everything at this point. go ahead, Zoe.
Oh, yeah. Just one point I was going to add, which I think is interesting here, is the security issue, right? So Google may very well be collecting credit card numbers. It's possible. It sounds like they're only collecting tokens. So maybe they're not actually collecting the numbers themselves. But it does seem like in this process of sharing this information, I mean, you're adding some additional vulnerabilities potentially into this process. So if if there was some sort of breach in this process, it would be catastrophic, right? I mean, just the amount of credit cards at stake. And so I bring this up because credit card breaches are just a nightmare. I've dealt with a few of them. And I think what's particularly hard about them is that the credit card brands have this incredibly onerous and opaque, and I would say unfair process in many circumstances of imposing fines on, you know, the parties that are have caused the breach, you know, whether it's the merchant or the credit card processor or what have you. And the fines are imposed contractually by these contracts I was mentioning that are passed down through the chain, you know, kind of through the ecosystem of the payment card industry. You know, and so, you know, the credit card brand will say, you know, they have this semi-process that they spell out in their documents, which is really hard to find, you know, for X amount of cards, you know, the fine is going to be this amount. And if we think that you've been, you know, particularly negligent, then the fine is going to be this amount. And there's like no appeal process. And they basically just give you the bill. And, you know, what are you going to do? Like not accept credit cards anymore if you're a merchant? That's not going to happen. And so I would love to see personally as kind of like a fight between Godzilla and King Kong, like if Google, you know, did have some sort of breach of this and then had to, you know, front up against the credit card brand industry and, you know, see which side would win out there, you know, because if there's, I mean, generally the credit card brands are not afraid of anyone. They're like these huge gargantuan, you know, elephants that you really have to use if you're going to, you know, do any sort of commerce. But, you know, Google is a, you know, big elephant in its own right. So I would like to see that face off. I mean, I wouldn't like to have that breach happen by any means, but that would be interesting.
It would. And, you know, the other thing that's really interesting that that also broke just this last week, in fact, just yesterday, is this promise from Google. Here we have its CEO speaking yesterday during a launch event in San Francisco. I'm looking at a picture and not actually where we're taking the data from. My mistake. This is the announcement about Google's browser came yesterday and is expected to go into effect early in 2018. And one of the things that Chrome will be able to do when they roll this out is basically it's Google's effort to help advertisers find a middle ground between people using their own ad blocking software and blocking ads altogether and basically opting out of the ad experience. Advertisers hate this, and Google wants to find a way of saying, okay, well, some of your ads are really onerous for consumers, and we're going to allow them to automatically block certain ads that we think fall into that category, which they're calling annoying experiences. And in turn, some of the users are going to be able to make the choice, you know, if they are financially in the position to do so, that they're going to be able to pay their way out of seeing other ads. So there's going to be this economic ecosystem in place where the advertisers who might find themselves ad blocked and get no compensation for those users will have some compensation, but it's going to flow through Google and its browser using this system. So this seems like a really interesting development to consider alongside Google providing more tools to marketers about linking offline and online activity. Are they really kind of playing both ends of this, Zoe?
Yes. Yeah. So, right. So they're collecting all this information and then combining it, you know, potentially with credit card information. And then at the same time, I guess, you know, just, well, I mean, I guess they're trying to, what I think really what they're trying to do, right, is they're trying to avoid people using ad blockers, right? Because mm-hmm. they'd rather they see some ads than no ads at all. And so if that means that, you know, they have to pare it down to the ads that are less annoying, then they're willing to do that. you know, which I think is good, right? I mean, they're being responsive to consumers and consumers' concerns. So they'll definitely, you know, create a better experience for all of us. I'm sure everyone has their pet peeves with ads, but, you know, my favorite pet peeve is that the videos that show up when you're trying to read like an article online, and, you know, and then it, you know, it has sound and pictures and so forth, and it just makes it impossible to concentrate and you're frantically trying to turn the sound off. You know, so I'm sure everyone has their favorite pet peeve, but I think it would make, you know, the browsing experience a lot more pleasant for everybody. If, you know, they can accurately, I guess, identify the ads that people find particularly annoying. I mean, I guess, yeah. So sorry, go ahead.
Well, and it's also, you know, for those who are willing to pay for it, it wants to offer this experience, where, let's see, they're letting publishers charge for ad-free access and they're calling it funding choices. We want to provide consumers with choice, Scott Spencer, director of product management at Google, told Ad Age. The publisher will get compensated either way, and it will help explain to the consumer the value of advertising. So they're, you know, they're actually paying for the service that they were getting for free by letting it be ad supported. I wonder how that parses. You're not seeing the ad, but are you not also getting targeted and tracked? They're not really going into that. If you're paying for this funding choices option, are you also paying for more privacy, or are you simply just not seeing the ad, that the information that everyone has about you would otherwise serve up to you? I don't know the answer to that question. What do you think, Zoe?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think that you're probably right that it does make a difference in tracking, right? Because a lot of the point of tracking is to see that if you look at an advertisement and then, you know, go click over to the website that the advertisement is from, or if you click on the advertisement itself, and then if that converts into an actual sale. So if the advertisement isn't there, then there's a lot less incentive to track you, right? Because you're not going through the link process, you know, from the advertisement. And so there's less incentive to see if the advertisement is working. So I think, yes, from that perspective, but I'm sure that there's still some tracking going on, right? I mean, to see what website you came over to that website from. I mean, at the minimum, right, every site has its own kind of analytics to determine, you know, what web pages you look at, whether you go from one page to another and then buy something on that site, right? So it's not like cookies are going away. It's just probably the third-party advertisements.
Mike, does it? It sort of frightens me. I'm wondering how you feel about it. The notion that a certain class of consumer is going to have more access to privacy if they have the disposable income to justify paying for it.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's a bit upsetting that we create this kind of bifurcated consumer population. I must say that, you know, having an ad-free browsing experience certainly sounds delightful for reasons, as Zoe mentioned. You know, how many times do we get blasted with these videos and you scroll through and try to find where the video is even on the page that you're looking at, so you can shut it down or turn it off or what have you. But yeah, I think you're right. That's a really good point, that we're kind of creating this, you know, this system of different consumer experiences depending on, you know, what your economic abilities are.
Right. And I actually just ignored my own distinction when I framed that question. I said certain people are going to be able to pay for privacy, but we're not even sure, as you more accurately stated, what they're going to be paying for is a more pleasant browsing experience. It'll be interesting to see the terms of service that roll out, if any updates to Chrome's terms of service accompany this, that shed any more light on if you are making that payment in addition to the more pleasant browsing experience, what else you may be getting. I'm very interested to see what happens there. All right. Anything else anyone want to add to this discussion of ads, privacy, and credit cards? Zoe, anything you want to conclude with?
No, nothing to add. It's been a great discussion.
Mike?
Same.
All right.
This will be
Matt?
A great development to watch.
Yeah.
I do just want to add quickly, there is a great First Amendment case that just came out from the Supreme Court relating to whether credit cards by state law can prohibit people from saying that they're charging a differential amount if you use a credit card or if you use debit card or cash. And the Supreme Court got it right. So to end that very depressing segment with something a little uplifting is that now your grocery store is not prohibited from telling you that you're actually paying 3% more to use your credit card. So I think that's exciting.
Yeah, that is exciting.
That is some good news.
Yes, thank you for that. All right, let's move on. And since we've been talking about what can be done with your data and how it's gathered, et cetera, let's revisit this new piece of legislation that was recently introduced called the Browser Act. So does this address what we've been discussing, Zoe? This is a piece of proposed legislation that Congress is considering. We don't know what will happen with it. It's basically just a couple of weeks on the table at this point, but it would require more disclosure and more consent from consumers. It would require, let's see, the legislation's primary focus is sectored into two categories. User information considered sensitive would be subjected to an opt-in approval system, meaning the data would only be permitted for company use if the person gives clear approval. In contrast, user information deemed non-sensitive would be subject to an opt-out approval system in which data is automatically permitted for business operations unless notified otherwise. Have you looked at this legislation? Do you know who it's going to apply to? And do you have thoughts about how it might work, Zoe?
Yeah, I did take a look at this bill. So this is fascinating to me because it's kind of these representatives putting their money where their mouth is, I think, right? So it's basically replicating the FCC rules that were voted down by Congress, I guess it was about a month or so ago now. But adding something to it, right? So one of the big criticisms of the FCC rules or justifications for voting down the FCC rules was that they were not technology neutral. So the FCC rules just apply to internet access providers, and those are, you know, the Comcasts and Verizons of the world, the people who give you access to the internet. And the FCC rules would have required basically, you know, what Denise is just talking about, which is the same as in this bill, that the internet access providers get opt-out consent for using and disclosing non-sensitive data that's going through their wires, and get opt-in consent for sensitive data going through their wires. And so sensitive information is defined the same way in the FCC rules as it is defined in this proposed bill as financial information, health information, children's information, social security number, precise geolocation information, the content of communications, and then also web browsing history. So it's very, very similar. And so that makes sense. You know, you can see why people would not necessarily want that information shared and disclosed, at least without their express consent. So what's different about this bill is that it not only applies to it not only applies to the internet access providers, it also applies to edge providers. And so that's basically everyone online, you know, the Googles and the Facebooks and you know, newspapers, the Amazons, they have this very broad definition of what they call of edge providers as, you know, any site that you can use to subscribe or establish an account, purchase without a subscription, search engines. So pretty much everyone, you know, that you're likely, every service provider online that you're likely to use on a regular basis, these same rules would apply to. So getting back to my point before, one of the big criticisms of the FCC rules was that it was unfair, right? It was treating the internet access providers differently from the edge providers online by imposing these opt-in, opt-out restrictions on internet access providers and not imposing it on the edge providers, you know, the Googles and so on of this world. And so that was the reason that many legislators gave in voting it down. And I cynically thought that that was just an excuse, that really they just didn't like, these additional consumer protections, which, maybe it's legitimate if you think that they're imposing too many costs on business. But I didn't think that that was really the reason, because I think that there's clearly a stronger argument for imposing these types of restrictions on the internet access providers than on the online providers like Google, because I think that there's a stronger argument that the internet access providers have monopolies. And also, that you have to, in order to kind of participate in the modern world, that you have to get online in some way, and usually, broadband. And so as a result, you have to use one of these internet access providers. And so as a result, it makes some sense to impose some restrictions on them regarding what they can do with consumer data. So what's interesting about this law is that these Republicans are who are proposing this bill are basically solving the problem that they said they saw with the FCC rules, and they're coming up with a law that basically imposes the same restrictions on both the edge providers and the internet access providers. Maybe I'm being still too cynical by thinking, maybe they're just proposing this because they know how there's no way it could possibly pass. And and it gives them some cover for their argument for voting down the FCC rules. And the reason I say that there's no way it could possibly be enacted into law is that I see it as being just incredibly infeasible, right? So it's asking that edge providers, right, all these online providers like Amazon and so on, get opt-in consent anytime they're going to use, disclose, access sensitive information, which includes the content of communications and web browsing history, right? So if you're familiar with how the internet works, I mean, that's just infeasible. Everyone collects that stuff and has to share that stuff. And it's not necessarily a case of, a service like Gmail where, they may be perusing the content of your emails and deciding what advertisements to give you as a basis for what's in those emails. But a lot of companies have to use service providers in some shape or form, and they have to share, they have to give access to the service providers as a part of providing their service. It's just kind of a means of doing business. And so, pretty much every company has to use and share this information as just, to be online. So what it would mean, I think, in practice is that this law is going to put up, these opt-in gates for any step, every step that people take online, and be just incredibly burdensome and unworkable. So I guess this gets to my point before about how I think it does make sense to treat the online service providers differently than the internet access providers, right? Because most people just have one internet access provider, and you only change, internet access providers every few years, if that. So you're only dealing with this opt-in issue very infrequently. Whereas online, it's going to be constantly, right? Every time you go from one website to another. So that strikes me as particularly infeasible. Another point that I think is worrisome about this this bill, and maybe wouldn't prevent it from passing, I don't know, but I do think it's worrisome, is that it preempts all state laws relating to the privacy of user information. So that's an incredibly broad preemption. Yeah. So among other things, it would preempt the California Online Privacy Protection Act, right, which is the law basically that forces any service provider who is selling or, has any, potential of being dragged into court in California of making them include a privacy policy on their website. So that would be preempted by this law. So this law does have a privacy policy provision. It does require privacy policies, but it doesn't spell out what has to be in that privacy policy. And please let me know if I'm missing something here. Maybe I missed it. But I mean, it strikes me just telling people that they have to have a privacy policy, but not telling them what has to be in the privacy policy is pretty much useless, right? Because you can just have a privacy policy that says, we value your information. Whereas, the California Online Privacy Protection Act, you know, it's not that stringent really about what has to be in a privacy policy, but it does say at least you have to explain, you know, what information you're collecting and, you know, who you're disclosing it to. So in that sense, I think it's this law is really undermining privacy protections, just a whole slew of them. I mean, there are so many state laws in this area. Another law I would just think of off the bat is the fact that almost every state has a social security number protection statute. And so among other things, they prohibit sending or obtaining social security numbers through a website and then sending that information across the internet unencrypted. So that seems like something that would be preempted by this law potentially because it's relating to user privacy online. And, you know, that's just one of many laws like that. So I think that this bill, at least in its current state, could never pass. And so maybe I'm being a bit cynical, but I just wonder if it was intended to pass. Though, you know, I mean, I think you could potentially make some changes to it and it could be workable. So that's my overview of thoughts on this.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to watch this one. I think you just gave us our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, which is going to be, pass this bill, really, say the lawmakers who proposed this. If you are a lawyer or another professional who likes to listen to the show for professional credit in your field, we put these phrases in so that you can demonstrate that you really watched or listened to the show. If you need more information about that as a lawyer, head to wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law page there, and we've got more information for you right there. Yeah, I think this one will be super interesting to watch for all the reasons you just said. It had not hit me that it might preempt the California privacy law that just about everyone everywhere has to comply with because everyone everywhere does business in California. And the other really interesting thing that you raise is if this were to pass, what people's mobile and desktop online experiences would look like, because you would need opt-in approval, and that is described as a method for obtaining from a user of a covered service consent to use, disclose, or permit access to sensitive user information, under which the provider of the service obtains express consent, allowing the requested usage, disclosure, or access to the sensitive user information. So, well, I'm going to tell you in a second what's sensitive under this. But just imagine every single time information is being collected about you, you're getting a pop-up that has to tell you what the requested usage of that information is, and you have to click yes in order to proceed. Number one, people will get even more desensitized to what they're giving consent for because it will just be everywhere. I don't know what number two was. Here's the sensitive information. financial information, health information, information pertaining to children under the age of 13, your social security number, precise geolocation information. I don't know what imprecise geolocation information is supposed to be. Content of communications. And here we go, the big kicker, web browsing history, history of usage of a software program, including a mobile application, and the functional equivalents of either. So very, very interesting if this thing were to pass. And you may well be right in your cynical assessment of why it's even on the table, Zoe. Mike, anything to add?
Yeah, I can't possibly see a scenario where this bill in its current form passes. I mean, can you imagine the lobbying effort that's going to take place here? I mean, you've got all the ISPs, all the edge providers coming together to try to defeat it. I mean, I just don't see it happening. And even if it gets past the House, will it get past the Senate? And then even if it gets that far, is the president going to sign it? So I don't know. I don't see it happening.
And just adding to your cynical theory, or more support for your cynical theory, Zoe, is that apparently AT&T, like the lawmakers who proposed it, thinks it's great and has applauded it for providing a comprehensive and uniform privacy framework that applies across the entire internet ecosystem. And maybe it doesn't cost AT&T anything to say that if they don't think there's much chance of the act actually passing. Facebook and Google and others have begun to poke holes in it and say why it's a bad idea. Matt, anything else that you'd like to add on this?
I applaud all three of you. I think you covered every point of this. So I could only second your sentiments.
All right, then let's take a break here and thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Betterment, the largest independent online financial advisor. Betterment is designed to help improve customers' long-term returns and lower taxes for retirement planning, building wealth, and other financial goals. Betterment takes advanced investment strategies and uses technology to deliver them to more than 250,000 customers. Based on the information you share, Betterment will make tailored recommendations on decisions like how much to invest, how much risk to take on your portfolio, and the type of investment account you should have. On average, Betterment's tax-coordinated portfolio can increase portfolio value by an estimated 15% over 30 years. Betterment gives you a clear view of your net worth when you sync your outside accounts, such as bank accounts and other investments. Another reason to choose Betterment: low transparent advisory fees compared to traditional services, only 0.25% on assets under management, with the option to upgrade to 0.4 to 0.5% for access to a CFP or licensed financial expert. Betterment cares about keeping your money and data secure, which is why they use enhanced data encryption and login protection. If you want to talk to someone about your specific financial situation, you can access their team of licensed financial experts. Investing involves risk. For a limited time, you can get up to 6 months managed for free. For more information, visit betterment.com/twill. That's betterment.com/twill. Betterment, rethink what your money can do. All right, let us move on to another area of Zoe's expertise. We've been talking about privacy, but Zoe's firm, the Littler Firm, does a lot of consulting on employment issues with clients, and Zoe's expertise on online issues has taken her to analyze and consider, write about various issues that affect employees and employers involving social media use. So we wanted to touch on some of that. A couple of really interesting topics that you've thought about, written about, Zoe. Let's start with one that comes up all the time for people using social media and also being an employee and blurring the lines of their social media use. So, you know, promoting things that their company's doing, talking about, you know, we were talking about the Google employee and the fact that almost all of Google's blog posts are written by employees on the Google blog. So we have this official blog post from Sridhar Ramaswamy, for example, the senior vice president of ads and commerce at Google that we were talking about earlier in the show. And you wouldn't be surprised at all if Mr. Ramaswamy also has a Twitter account that perhaps is pointing to that blog post that he made or expanding upon it or further commenting about the large Google Marketing Next event that's been going on. So this is just something that's ubiquitous where people are operating on certain social media accounts in clearly an official capacity, and at the same time, they're posting, you know, what they had for lunch, as well as, hey, go read this article I posted on the Google blog on a different account. And so I think it gets really difficult to parse out who has access to what accounts, who should have access to what accounts, and what happens, of course, when people part ways. You have a piece called Whose Social Network Account? A Trade Secret Approach to Allocating Rights. Can you just sort of give us the takeaway from that piece for folks employers and employees might want to be thinking about as they navigate these waters?
Yeah, sure. So As you mentioned, there's a lot of times kind of a blurring of the lines with regard to whether the employer or the employee owns an account that an employee has been using both for, you know, personal reasons, but also for the benefit of the employer, right? To to, I guess, pursue the employer's business interests in some way, shape, or form. So I got the idea for this article a few years ago based on the phone dog case, which is was a pretty famous case at the time, but it's been a while. So I might just quickly refresh folks' memory on that or explain it for those who weren't aware of it at the time. So this is a case where there's a company called Phone Dog, which provides reviews on mobile telephones. And so they employed a lot of reviewers who would write articles about, you know, the latest developments in mobile technology. And many of those reviewers had Twitter accounts. And so one of the employees, a guy named Noah Kravitz, had a very successful Twitter account where he had 17,000 followers. And so he used that Twitter account in the way that Denise just described, right? So partly to provide information about developments in mobile phone technology, but also just to talk about his personal life and just to post kind of whimsical things about like his thoughts on unicorn paintings or what have you. So he left the company and he took his Twitter account with him. And the company was not so pleased about that and so filed a lawsuit to try to get it back. And so the question was raised, you know, who in this circumstance has the ownership of the Twitter account and how do we figure that out? So it's kind of a tough question and an important one because in this case, right, there are 17,000 people who are following that Twitter account. And so you might say, well, you know, it's really easy to unfollow a Twitter account or switch over to another one. And that's absolutely true, but it's not so easy to get 17,000 people to follow it, right? I mean, that takes some time. So there's some value in building that up because, you know, when you have all those people attached to your Twitter account or, you know, the same holds true for other types of social network accounts, you basically have kind of a radio into that to that person, like a direct line. So if you tweet something, it shows up directly in their Twitter feed and they get your message. So that's really valuable. And so this is something that, you know, there's real need to try to figure out who gets the rights to it. But it's one of those round hole square peg problems because the question doesn't really fit neatly under any of the kind of existing regimes of law. Right. So usually trademark law is the regime of law that is used to determine, you know, who owns kind of property online. And I'm thinking particularly of the domain name context where, you know, if someone tries to take the KentuckyFriedChicken.com domain name, the Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise or, you know, enterprise would have a pretty strong claim to getting that back on the grounds that it's confusing from a trademark perspective for someone else to have that that domain name. But in this context, right, Noah Kravitz, when he left PhoneDog, he changed the name of his handle on Twitter. It was PhoneDog_Noah, I believe, or PhoneDog_Kravitz. But in any case, it had PhoneDog in it, and he just took PhoneDog off of it. So that pretty much nullified a trademark claim that PhoneDog could make, or at least made it a lot harder. And so that's true for other regimes, too. Another fit that might seem natural is trade secrets, right? Because trade secret law does protect customer lists as trade secret information, you know, depending on if you keep it secret enough and if it really has value based on the fact that it's secret. And so you could argue, you know, that all these links are kind of like a customer list. But the thing is, in this case, with the Twitter account, they're not secret, right? That's kind of public information, all the people who are following this particular Twitter account. So trade secret doesn't fit there very neatly. So my thought was that perhaps the kind of legal regime to resolve these disputes with is, in fact, trade secret law, but taking kind of a different approach and arguing that the login credentials themselves are the trade secret. Right. And so this is a credible argument. It kind of fits more or less under the trade secret principles. Right. So the definition of a trade secret under trade secret law is that the trade secret has to be information that's not generally known or readily ascertainable. And so login credentials are secret. The information has to be subject to reasonable efforts to maintain its secrecy. So, yes, you know, most people are not sharing their passwords everywhere. And then it has to derive independent economic value from its secrecy. So you might think mm-hmm. of Coke's special recipe formula, I guess, for Coca-Cola, right? It has value because it's secret. You can't get it from anywhere but Coke. And so, the access to this to a Twitter account like that does have economic value due to its secrecy, because you have the advantage of having a unique link to all these people, and that you can control yourself. No one else is getting in there and kind of diluting the value of it by sharing their messages. It's just your messages that you choose to send out through that kind of one-way radio, I guess. Mm-hmm. So that was my argument. I think it's a little bit of a stretch, right? Because what you're protecting is not the information underneath. You're protecting the password. Trade secret law doesn't protect information because it's valuable in itself. It protects information because it derives value from being secret. And so, the secret access is potentially the value. And so I thought this was maybe a good fit, because trade secret law seems to be generally well designed to deal with this problem of allocating rights between employers and employees. It's a problem that comes up a lot, and there's a lot of case law and principles under trade secret law designed to deal with that problem. Mm-hmm. So just one other point I'll add is that trade secret law is also well designed to deal with this problem of who owns the rights to something, kind of ab initio. And that's not an issue that really comes up in many other areas of law, right? So in the real property context, there's always, that property existed, it was probably never not in existence. And so there's always kind of a chain of ownership. Whereas in intellectual property, you often have a case where an employee is creating something during the course of employment that never existed before, whether that's an invention or a book or a movie. And so intellectual property law has to deal with the question of who gets the rights to it in that circumstance. And so the default rule, of course, is that the creator gets the rights. And then that's modified by either the work made for hire doctrine in copyright law, or the hire to invent doctrine in patent and trade secret law. And so in patent and trade secret law, it's the hire to invent doctrine. And under that doctrine, right, it's basically if you are hired to make something for the employer, then it belongs to the employer. And you look at factors like, did the employer ask the employee to do this? Was it made to serve the employer's interests? Did they have any sort of written agreement or understanding about this? And so I think the same applies here. If you have an employee who creates an account and they're asked to do it by the employer, it's to promote the employer's business, they use the employer's password, your employer email address to do it, then I think, there's a pretty strong argument that the employer is paying you for that and should get to keep it. Conversely, if you do it on your own time and it's really for your own personal reasons, then a strong argument that you should keep it. So, but at least mm-hmm. I think trade secret law gives kind of a framework for trying to address that problem. So that was kind of the thought behind behind this.
Have you seen cases where a court has had to sort of analyze the substance of somebody's tweets, for example, during the scope of their employment, and parse out what percentage was related to the employment and what percentage was related to, say, cute dog photos, and decide, okay, based on that percentage, this account belongs to the employee or the employer?
I haven't seen a real analysis of that question, like a detailed mm-hmm. analysis of that question. And I think part of the reason for that is that everyone was kind of, employers at least, were all kind of woken up by the phone dog case. And there were two other cases that were kind of similar around the same time. And mm-hmm. so now employers generally have their employees sign a social media account agreement that clarifies, and I draft these all the time, that clarifies that an account that you make for the employer belongs to the employer. And typically employers will try to protect themselves by making sure that any accounts that employees work on are accounts that have been opened up, while they were employees at the employer or, by a previous employee, and that, that everyone has the login information so that they can't just kind of change the password and run off with it, that they use their company email address, so it's really clear that it's related to the company and not their personal lives. So I think that has, you know, dramatically reduced the number of disputes in this area. But I would be really interested in seeing a case like that.
Yeah, I would too. Mike, any questions about the ownership issue of accounts before we move to sort of the flip side of it, which is the amount or degree of freedom that employees may have to do what they want in their own social media channels?
No questions from my perspective. I really enjoyed reading your article and thought it was a clever, interesting approach to the issue.
Mm-hmm. Matt, well,
thank you. Did you actually read the whole thing?
Oh, goodness.
Really, as a matter of fact, I came close.
I'm flattered and impressed.
I enjoyed it.
Matt, anything else you want to suss out here before we move to sort of the related issue?
Just is there any resources that you're available to point companies to like, start thinking about this that are going to have this problem other than calling you and your services, which I recommend.
Right. Well, I think resources, so Harvard has the whatchamacallit center at Harvard. I'm sure
you're Berkman.
Probably some
Berkman.
Yes. They have a really good kind of social media or media law website, which I think has a lot of useful information. I don't know if it covers this particular topic, but it's really great for anyone who's trying to kind of make a business of their blog or anything along those lines.
Great. Thank
right.
you.
And I always think it's interesting when you see, and there are usually media personalities who, you know, have a large social media following and have incorporated their company's trademark, logo, et cetera, in their account. And I always wonder whether that's required by the company or they just thought it was a good idea because they're affiliated with the company and how all that goes. But from the employee standpoint, I never feel like that's a good idea because you're raising the kind of confusion that could lead to a company saying, you don't get to have that account. It's ours. So the flip side here, another thing that Zoe has written about and considered is, and we've talked about on the show a lot, and I like to highlight for people because I think people probably think they have more latitude to stay employed than they actually do. And under the notion that, you know, we live in a country with a First Amendment and I have freedom of speech and I can do what I want on my own time when I'm outside of work. And by and large, people overestimate the protections that they have in that regard. And by and large, unless you have an employment agreement or live in a state where added protections are available to you, you might find yourself, like many, many people are, either an at-will full-time employee or, even less protections as a contract employee, an independent contractor, where your employer doesn't have to put up with anything you're doing online. And aside from, there are some limited exceptions to that that deal with labor relations and things. But, if your employer objects to your conduct online and the way that it reflects on the company, in many instances, they can just pull the rug out from under you and fire you. So can you expand on that a bit for us, Zoe, and help people understand better what employers' rights are and employees' rights are as far as political activism? One of the pieces we have linked in the rundown this week, which everyone can view all the pieces that we've looked at to prepare for the show. If you go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, we're on episode number 388 this time around. So one of the pieces that we've got there points out, this is from the Washington Post, that we're in a political climate right now where people are really doing a lot of activism. Social media seems to be the environment where that's taking place, creating trails of everything everybody does. A lawyer quoted in that piece says, I think people would be aghast to know that those rights are not guaranteed in most states. Do you agree with him, Zoe?
Yes, I think that there's a common misconception that the First Amendment protects your rights as an employee to say whatever you want. And that's not the case for at least for employees of private employers. So even for public employees, there's a limit to that, right? So there's a long line of cases which balance the First Amendment rights of public employees, right? So those are employees of, you know, state governments and public school systems and so on, against the employers, what they call legitimate interests in efficient workplace and avoiding disruption in the workplace. So even in that context, you're not home free to say whatever you want. So this has become, I think, a particularly big issue in the last 10 years or so with the rise of social media, because, of course, in the past, when you said something, most likely your employer was not going to get wind of it. But now, you know, people are expressing whatever they think on social media, and it's being captured there for the public to see, and also, you know, potentially for eternity. And the employer is getting wind of it. And so you might still think, you know, why is this any business of the employers? And I think, you know, in a lot of cases, it isn't any business of the employers. And, in most cases, I think employers, don't really want to mess around with people's personal lives and what they're saying there. But there are some areas where employers really do have a legitimate interest in imposing some restrictions on what their employees are saying or potentially disciplining them based on what they're saying. So one is, of course, you know, trade secrets and confidential information. So it's not just trade secrets, right? So if you're a hospital, you are very concerned about having any of your employees post anything about your patients online. And it can be very harmless sometimes, right? It can be like a nurse, at the children's hospital taking pictures with little Johnny that they've grown, you know, that she's grown to become very affectionate with over the course of, you know, his cancer treatment. But, you know, you're absolutely violating HIPAA by posting that information online and violating the privacy of the child and also getting the hospital in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. So that type of thing. Another point that becomes a big problem for employers is sexual harassment. And this happens a lot, right? So I should just give a bit of a disclaimer here, right? So Littler Mendelsohn is a labor and employment law firm. It's actually the biggest labor and employment law firm in the world. I should also say that nothing I say here represents the views of the company, and also nothing I say here is legal advice. Probably should have said that earlier, but so here it is now. Us lawyers do try to dot our I's. As I was going to say, I deal with privacy and data security and technology law, and it often comes up or usually comes up in the employment context. I get a lot of calls about employees who have engaged in sexual harassment in some form, on social media off duty, you know, where they're sending, you wouldn't believe what happens, right? So they're sending they're posting about their supervisee and, you know, how hot she is on social media. And, you know, legitimately it's lightning out the window. So legitimately the employer, is concerned about that. As a matter of fact, has an obligation in those cases to investigate and find out what's going on and determine whether this is actually sexually harassment, that they need to do something about. And I think a similar issue is racism. So employees sometimes will make just horrifyingly racist remarks on social media. And, you know, sometimes the way the employer finds out about that is they get, you know, a call from a concerned member of the public saying, you know, your employee said this. Does it represent what you think? And, you better do something about this because I'm going to report it to the media and you're going to get a whole lot of unwanted publicity. And, employers are seeing a lot more of this in the last year than they did before. So, you know, whatever your views are about our president and you know, whether he's had any cause in this, I mean, I've certainly seen a big uptick in employees saying, you know, really offensive racist remarks and feeling like, you know, they can get away with that. And then employers being stuck trying to kind of figure out what they're going to do about that. So although the First Amendment, generally does not apply, there are protections. And so the biggest protection actually comes from the National Labor Relations Act, which is a 1930s era labor law. And so I won't go through it in great detail, but just to say, you know, it's a little surprising how much of an effect it has, because certainly, you know, social media was on no one's mind in the 1930s. But the National Labor Relations Board in recent years has taken a very vehement position that employees have a right to talk about the terms and conditions of their employment on social media. So just to give a little bit more of a background here. So the National Labor Relations Act protects the right of employees to organize and to bargain collectively. And so as part of that, they have a right to engage in protected concerted action, which includes discussions of the terms and conditions of their employment, right? So, you know, their salary and their health benefits and safety conditions amongst each other. And so the National Labor Relations Board has said, you know, in the past, maybe people were talking about this when they are at the bar or, you know, at the Sunday picnic or something, but now people talk about that on social media. And so they have a right to discuss those things on social media. And so the National Labor Relations Board has interpreted this right quite broadly. So the National Labor Relations Board is the agency that enforces the National Labor Relations Act. And so, among other things, they've struck down employer policies that they consider to be overbroad. So, for example, there have been a number of opinions from the National Labor Relations Board which say that, you know, if an employer social media policy prohibits an employee from making offensive, unprofessional, or inappropriate comments on social media, which is kind of the catch-all an employer might put in there to, you know, prohibit the things they can't think of right now, but you know it when you see it. The National Labor Relations Board has said, you know, that violates the National Labor Relations Act because the reasonable employee would probably interpret that to prevent them from criticizing management, which from management's point of view would probably be seen as unprofessional and inappropriate. Employers really have to be careful anytime they're disciplining someone or even writing a social media policy, imposing some restrictions on social media, to make sure that it doesn't fall into protected concerted activity. And so this relates very closely to political activity, because the National Labor Relations Board has taken the position that, you know, many forms of political activity that an employee might engage in is related to the terms and conditions of their employment. You know, so for example, attending a rally about raising the minimum wage. I think an employer would be ill-advised in cracking down on that. I mean, I don't think employers should do that anyway, but you know, I think there'd be some risk under the National Labor Relations Act. So that's a broad law, and it's a federal law, of course. So it doesn't matter what state you're in. Then depending on the state you're in, there can be a lot of protection. So there's some states like California, which generally tends to have kind of the most protections for employees, but it has this general lawful off-duty conduct law, right? That employees can't be disciplined for lawful off-duty conduct. So, you know, that covers a very broad range of types of things they might talk about or do. Then there are about six states that protect the right of employees to engage in lawful political activities, right? So including attending meetings and protests, running for office, protections along that score. And then there are the laws which I think are kind of funny, right, which is the lawful consumable products laws. And, you know, not surprisingly, a lot of these laws tend to be in tobacco producing states. But, you know, there's laws that prohibit employers from preventing their employees from smoking, for example, or drinking alcohol. Another set of laws relates to protecting employees' right to bear arms. So I think of this because I recently had a case where a daycare center called and said that the parents were all up in arms because they'd seen a picture of one of the daycare workers surrounded by unbelievable number of guns. And they were a little concerned about having, you know, their kids there. You know, and in North Dakota, there's a law protecting the right of employees to bear arms. So I think, you know, a daycare center in North Dakota would be in a risky position if it tried to, you know, fire someone because they posted the picture like this. of course, you know, maybe in North Dakota, parents wouldn't mind as much about that kind of thing and think that, you know, this is a good person to protect your kids. I don't know. But certainly in a lot of states, you know, people would be quite concerned about that. So there are protections, but certainly not as broad as the kind of the broad First Amendment protection that a lot of people think applies to them.
Yeah, North Dakota has some interesting, very, very gun-friendly laws. Just Googling real quickly, apparently in August of this year, permitless concealed carry for residents of North Dakota goes into effect. They already have open carry there. You can also have open carry of a loaded handgun, but you need that concealed weapons license to do that. So not surprising that you're... finding that law in that particular part of the country. Fascinating stuff, Zoe. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you've run into any interesting edge cases where something like what you were discussing earlier, say, offensive speech. You were talking about racist comments by employees that employers would want to know about and deal with. Have you ever found an argument, a successful argument made by the employee there that they were protected by the NLRA for that kind of speech because it's tangentially political?
Like a racist comment?
Yeah. Anything like that or anything just interesting, you know, that you wouldn't think would fall under the rubric of the labor laws that has found protection under this, the fact that political speech has been swept in there under their right to organize and communicate in that way.
Let's see. So I think a racist argument would be hard to protect. But, you know, the NLRB and the courts, you know, when these cases have been appealed, do give a lot of leeway for offensive remarks to the if they are kind of stated in a context of talking about the terms and conditions of employment. So, you know, a recent case, which I think is kind of emblematic of this, is a case where a restaurant, I guess the employees were in the process of potentially organizing for a vote and whether they should have a union. And apparently, you know, one of the managers was just kind of a jerk, it sounds like, you know, and he was kind of pushing employees around and swearing at them and so on. And so there was one incident in which an employee kind of reached his boiling point. And so he went out on his break and he complained about his boss by name. And then, can I swear on this show?
we try and keep our clean tags in the various places that we distribute. Okay. So,
well, right. So he says, you know, at the end of it, F you, vote for the union. And, you know, and so that's kind of a one of the tough questions under the National Labor Relations Act, you know, to what extent, at what point is an employee's comment so offensive that it's no longer protected under the National Labor Relations Act, right? So you're
that's exactly really what I was trying to ask. where is that point?
Right. And so, you know, the board ruled in that case, well, that was fine. You know, so basically it seems like as long as you say vote for the union after anything you say, then you're probably okay.
Oh, my God.
That's the tip for the week.
Okay, now you've given us our second MCLE passphrase for the episode, which is going to be vote for the union as something to include in your online speech. If you're in a non-unionized field, well, then I suppose you'd still be protected because you could, you know, be arguing for the field to become unionized. So,
oh, absolutely, it's yeah. Unionized or non-unionized in right. Workplaces. So, yeah, you're absolutely yes. Right.
Yeah.
But I think more seriously, getting to your question, I think so clearly defamatory comments are generally not protected. Also, disparaging the employer's products and services is not protected. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to criticize management and how they're dealing with you and maybe the minimum wage and other, you know, potentially political types of comments. But it's another thing, you know, to be disloyal, I guess, in that sense. The employer is considered to have a right, or not a right, but that the National Labor Relations Act does allow discipline when the employees are criticizing the products and services of the employer.
Right. Okay, we have a couple of more stories I want to cover before we wrap up the show today. But just before we leave this topic, Mike, anything more to ask Zoe or anything you want to add?
Really great discussion. Very interesting. I guess one question about the National Labor Relations Act, and you said that it allows employees the right to unionize, or I can't remember exactly what the language was that you used, Zoe, but this law doesn't just apply if you're a union shop, right? This would apply to any employers potentially, even if they don't have unions that, or am I wrong on that?
No, you're absolutely right. So I think a lot of people think that the scope of this law is a lot more limited than it is. So it's any employee. It doesn't apply. Generally apply to independent contractors, but it basically any employee, right? So it's a really broad protection.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And then I'm sure this is far too much for us to probably far too much for us to get into on this show today, but I assume that there's got to be all sorts of restrictions and regulations dealing with in the pre-employment context. What you can do as a potential employer? Can you look at somebody's social media accounts and can you take what they've done into consideration in the hiring context? It sounds to me like that would probably be fraught with peril.
Yeah, it is definitely fraught with peril. And I get this question a lot, right? So to what extent can they do that, right? Because, you know, potentially if there's something really negligent or stupid that, you know, an applicant has shown themselves doing on social media, and then the employer hires them and they go ahead and do something, you know, equally negligent and stupid on behalf of the employer, right? The employer could be liable for negligence. So they have a real reason to want to look at this stuff. So, I mean, first of all, there are the password protection laws, right, which you're probably familiar with. About more than half the states now, I believe, have these laws that prohibit employers from even requesting access to applicants' social media accounts. There's also the Federal Stored Communications Act, which prohibits accessing, you know, communications stored with a third-party service provider, you know, so your Facebook posts, to the extent that they're not publicly available. But that doesn't protect publicly available information, right, that you might have generally across your social media. And I think that the real peril there, and there are a number of them, but probably the biggest one is, I think, discrimination claims, right? So when you're looking at someone's social media information, you potentially discover a lot of information about them. You might, for example, find that someone's pregnant, right? And, And then, you know, if you decide not to hire that applicant, even if it's for a legitimate reason, and they discover, you know, that part of your practice was viewing social media, they might have a convincing argument to a jury that the real reason that you didn't hire them was because you discovered that they were pregnant, or, you know, that they're a member of some religious minority, for example. There's just a lot of stuff you can find out about people, and, you know, it could fall into a protected category under discrimination law.
Yeah, and it seems like it would be hard to get at the real motives there. That if you're an employee and you suspect you've been, or a would-be employee and you weren't hired, and you suspect you were discriminated against for some, you know, some actually protected reason that they shouldn't have based the decision on, if that information about you is publicly out there and available, it seems like it would be hard to make that claim. Right,
yeah,
you're not going to be able to evidentially. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, have you? You're the employment lawyer here. Have you seen people attempt to make that claim and then get into in discovery? You know, I want to see the browser history of everyone who was involved in this decision making tree. You think you could get there and show? Yeah, look, they looked at this post where I'm clearly pregnant, and they didn't hire me.
Yeah, well, basically any claim that you could possibly imagine has been filed in the employment context. So applicants are and employees are often filing claims that they've been discriminated against in some way. And, you know, often they'll just use that honestly as kind of a settlement tactic. So they might just get some money to make them go away. But as far as that question about whether it gets to that point of discovery, no, not usually in a single plaintiff type of case, but I think in a class action case, that could definitely happen.
Yeah. All right, Matt, if you're not too exhausted, could you tell us about the Supreme Court's recent decision about patent exhaustion?
And we'll, yes, I can.
Wait one second. Victor has something to do beforehand.
Someday I'll get it.
Because it's patent time. Thank you.
Sorry, Victor. So the patent exhaustion doctrine, recent Supreme Court case that came out. Once again, the Supreme Court is very active in patent litigation right now, and I think the last two decisions have been excellent. So this one related to if you sell – so Lexmark is a printer company. They were selling printers and printer ink to consumers. Part of the contract that they put in with the consumer was that if you paid 20% less for your printer ink, then you – if you signed a contract to only refill with them, you would get this special printer ink cartridge which had a identifier on it, which was supposed to not allow the printer to work with the ink if it had been refilled somewhere else. Innovative third parties found a way around this. We're going to break this down. And then the question turned on whether they had an in rem right against the third party. If the contract they made with the their customer limiting their ability to sell this was applicable to the third party. And so there was a 25-person shop who was refilling printer cartridges, which was sued under this. And the court said, no, when you sell a patented object to the consumer, the patent is exhausted and you cannot bring a claim against a third party. If they had brought it against the original consumer, they could have brought it under contract claim. But typically, it's not strategically advantageous to sue your own customers, and therefore they wanted to sue the third parties. Another question, which I'm not as up on, is there was an international section, and so under patent law they had said that that the United States created a unique market, and therefore you could sell your items uniquely within the United States. In that you could essentially charge different rates for outside the United States because they couldn't sell the patented items back in the United States. And the United States said no to that. I think that's going to be a really interesting thing to watch. And the reason I don't know enough about it is I don't know if it applies in the drug context. There's a lot of patent drugs that are sold overseas that see a significant reduction in price over there that could theoretically be sold back here. But I think that's something we'll have to cover later, at least from my end.
Right. So we'll stay tuned on that point. But for the rest of us who use printers, under this decision, we should all be saving our cartridges now rather than throwing them away or whatever we do with them, because there's going to be this booming aftermarket in them, right?
Yeah, and this isn't just applicable to cartridges. I think that we've seen more and more companies who want to partially due to the time value of money, when you have low inflation rates, they want to go into a more like subscription based model, and so these companies are less able to do this because they can't enforce this against third parties. This could have application in the context of like the John Deere, which I know you guys have talked about before, the ability of the third parties to fix these. It seems like in order to uphold the strategy that John Deere has been going with, they would have to actually license the tractor to you, not sell the tractor to you, which is possible for them, but it definitely has to change their business model rather than just enforcing this on third parties. I think it's great. I think that this forces you to buy property in a way that we tend to think about property. And I think that's generally a good thing. So.
All right. Thank you for that. Thank you, Supreme Court. Go ahead,
Matt,
Zoe.
I, I had a question, right? So this is another case, right, where the Supreme Court disagreed with the Federal Circuit, which seems to be kind of part of their dysfunctional relationship in the realm of patents, where the Federal Circuit is supposedly the Supreme Court of patents, and then the Supreme Court is always kind of bumping them on the head and disagreeing with them. But I was wondering, you know, so I was following this a few years ago, and maybe I'm putting you in the spotlight, but what is the argument, I guess, in favor of allowing these post-sale restrictions? What would the other side argue?
So what the other side argued, and it's a fairly good argument, is that unlike the first sale doctrine in copyright, which is statutorily defined, there is no statutorily defined patent exhaustion doctrine. This is a judicially made law, and what we're citing is Lord Edward Coke from the 16th century. So the argument, like, from any modern interpretive method, like, you can't make this patent exhaustion doctrine without, like, at least relying on some natural rights concept of property or some, like, concept of this is how history has gone. So as a statutory measure, Lexmark had the better argument. The outcome is, I think, far superior this way.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I mean, I think someone did a calculation once that if you filled up your tank with printer ink, it would cost like something ridiculous, like $10,000, you know, because they're able to charge so much through these various schemes. So, yes, definitely better for consumers.
Yeah, and it's not only this. I mean, Whirlpool is a big. I mean, I think they own like 70 or 80% of the U.S. market. And what they're a large profit center that they're looking at is they want to sell water filters. And so they're putting patents in order to make the water filter fit between what the filter and it fits it up. And that's how they think they're going to make money. So they can sell their initial item lower and then create a revenue stream further on. And this is I think this is largely to do with low inflation rates and businesses, the cash value of getting money right away is not what it used to be. And so they're being innovative to develop revenue streams.
If Whirlpool just makes everything Internet of Things, then they're just going to participate in the ecosystem we were discussing at the top of the show and, you know, report back to home base about what dishes you're doing, what laundry you're doing, and what's in your fridge. Thank you for that, Matt.
Not all that exciting.
Yeah, they'll make their money that way. All right, let us move on to our final batch of stories, our final story, our final topic, which is copyright. So longtime listeners, viewers of the show will know that we've been talking about Prenda Law for years. These are the people who seeded sites like Pirate Bay with various porn videos, some of which they made themselves. Others they somehow had the rights to. And then engaged in this extortion practice where they would determine who had downloaded the videos and then come after those people and say, ooh, you have downloaded our copyrighted video and we have copyright claims against you, which will become public and the world will know that you've been enjoying this pornography. And instead of having to go through all that, please pay us $3,000 and we'll go away. These people have been roundly pummeled by the courts. One of them was suspended from practice of law last year. Most recently, Jonathan Steele, who sounds like he should star in a 50 Shades movie. Maybe he's Anastasia's brother or something. He's now been disbarred in his home state. And Mike, you made us promise not to do the story until you were on the show with us. So one thing we should just add too is not only, you know, have the Prenda lawsuits been thrown out and the lawyers now been disgraced, but they've also been hit with hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of sanctions by courts as well. So things are not going well for the Prenda people right now. And that probably feels good to everyone but them. What did you want to add, Mike?
Oh, I don't know that I have anything to add. You covered it beautifully. as I think we've talked about before, these guys, they racked up quite a lot in revenue from this extortionist scheme. I think somewhere to the tune of $6 million. So Mr. Steele and his confederates were quite busy for a number of years there. Their scheme was ultimately unmasked by Otis Wright, Judge Otis Wright in the Central District of California. If anybody's interested in that opinion, it's from 2013. It's actually a very masterfully done opinion. It's a sanctions order, actually, where he quotes Star Trek quite extensively, including The Wrath of Khan and all sorts of other references to the franchise. So yes, R.I.P. Prendelaw. They gave a bad name to lawyers and copyright lawyers in particular. So it's good that good that things are coming home to roost.
Yes. Anything to add, Zoe?
Yeah. So one thing I thought was really interesting about this case is the reliance on this argument, I guess, that Prendelaw had authorized people to download these videos, and therefore there was no legitimate claim of copyright infringement, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, generally speaking, right, if you own the copyright to something and someone, downloads it without, downloads it without your authorization, then you have a legitimate claim of copyright infringement. And that's what, you know, Prendelaw was claiming with their porn videos, that people were downloading them without authorization. And so the prosecutor here is making the argument, well, this was extortion and not a legitimate claim, not a legitimate demand for settlement on the part of Prendelaw, because there was no copyright infringement, because effectively Prendelaw had authorized people to download these videos by posting them on BitTorrent. And so I found that reasoning a bit troubling and a bit of a stretch, right? Because my understanding of authorization generally in the law is that authorization is an objective analysis or objective, is viewed, from the objective viewpoint of the person who's obtaining the consent. You know, so for example, if I say, yes, you can download my my video, and I say that to your face and shake hands on it, but inside internally I'm saying, no, you can't download my video. It doesn't really matter that that's what I think, because you very reasonably have taken what I said to mean yes. So it seems to me that if the way you're looking at authorization is from the viewpoint of the person obtaining the consent, what you need to look at is from the viewpoint of the people downloading these videos. And I think that, I think there's a pretty strong argument that they did not think that they had authorization, because otherwise, why would these videos be posted on, on Pirate Bay? So then to instead judge authorization by the subjective intent of the copyright holder, I think is turning the way that you generally look at authorization a bit on its head. And I think it raises a lot of questions for me about then what authorization means, because does that then mean, that pretty much everything online, and this is a bit of a stretch, but everything that's posted online is authorized for downloading, right? Because and that therefore there's no infringement for downloading it, or maybe you have more of an intermediate situation where you have a porn company that's posting some videos on its website, and it has kind of an honor system where people pay. And then as part of their revenue model, occasionally the porn company goes after people who download the videos without paying and gets even more from those people. Right. Mm-hmm. So could you argue in that case that, what they're demanding is extortion too? So I just thought the kind of the crux of this argument was interesting.
Right. It seems like what you're pointing out is the old adage, bad facts make bad law, and that the prosecutors here should be careful not to let their zeal to get at the Prenda folks and punish them result in some bad law that could damage the way copyright's supposed to function. Mike, do you have any reaction to this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really valid point that Zoe brings up. as Judge Wright noted in his sanctions order, he said, look, enforcing copyrights is perfectly legitimate, but not in the way in which they've done it, which is they had secretly set up these shell companies to, quote unquote, be the owners of the copyright in these various porn films that you, Denise, pointed out. They actually produced in some instances. And it was very much their intent. They had no intent other than to seed these various sites and stick them on Pirate Bay and other locations, and fully expected and intended people to download them, and then used that reality as a basis to extort money. So the very fact that the authors, quote unquote, of these films put these digital versions up on these websites really did act as the authorization for this to happen, because in fact that's what they intended all along. So yeah. I do see what you're saying, but it's a little bit of a unique circumstance, I suppose, in terms of licensing and authorization. But I guess the upshot is you can't really take advantage of the system by engaging in this nefarious practice and then going shaking down people for payment.
I mean, I agree with that, but it does seem like, you know, the people who downloaded these things probably thought that they were doing it without authorization. And I guess getting to Denise's point about bad facts making bad law. But I mean, I think that there would be a legitimate argument to say, you know, anytime you post something online, like, you've got to know, right, that people are going to download it without authorization, right? So that's maybe not your intent, but it's part of your frame of mind when you put it there. So does that undermine your claim for copyright infringement? You know, so it shouldn't. So anyway, I think this case is blurring a distinction, which I think should be more clear.
Right. Yeah, and I'm not quite sure where it stands procedurally, but I think the criminal prosecution is still going on. Is that right, Mike?
I believe that's correct. I think that there was with one or maybe multiple defendants here that they've already pled out, but I'm not sure what the status is with respect to everything. But, you know, the thing that made this case particularly unsavory was the principals in this law firm engaged in quite a bit of there was just a lot of half-truths and complete mistruths that were presented to the court that I think made them very unsympathetic.
Yes.
and that had to have played into this, I would think, to a significant degree. So,
yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Let's get to our of the show materials here. I'm about ready for an animal selfie of the week.
Oh, yeah.
How could you not be? This week's animal selfie is the non-traditional variety where no actual animal was aware that selfies of them were being taken. They did not trigger the actual taking of the selfies. They were just going about their really, really cute lives. A group of high school students and a couple of their teachers in Lincroft, New Jersey, put a camera trap in the woods, and they started seeing all kinds of great wildlife, and particularly a mom and just a gaggle of little kit foxes who did many a fine video for them. So I'm not sure what PETA would think of all this. If the kit foxes, would it factor in that the kits are not of majority age and cannot give their consent to be included in the wonderful trap camera videos? I'm not sure, but it's something that we could see come up in litigation on behalf of the foxes. But in the meanwhile, just enjoy their cuteness. And I too am perplexed that they're not called pup foxes. Why are they kits? They're really more of a dog than a cat, right? I don't know. All of you animal phylum and species experts out there, please let me know why kit foxes are called kits and not pups. Let us go on to our resource of the week. That is coming up at Stanford It is a wonderful, wonderful event if you're interested in or practicing law in particular, the areas that we love to cover on the show. It's the 14th annual Stanford E-Commerce Best Practices Conference. Really one not to miss if you have the opportunity not to miss it. Unlike a lot of the events that we promote that go on at Stanford that catch my eye and I let you know about on the show, this one is not free, but if you are a Stanford student, you could attend it for a mere $70. So I don't know how you turn that one down. They're going to take on such issues as protecting companies' interests in politically uncertain times with regard to globalism. They're going to talk about cross-border data flows, rights of publicity. We talked about that today on the show. Virtual reality, managing violations of rights that occur in virtual reality settings. All kinds of great, great issues. Just the kind of stuff that we love to talk about here. So if you have the chance to check out this conference or attend it, it is coming up on June 12th. So at minimum, you know, look for hashtag Stanford e-commerce or something like that on June 12th. I'm sure people will be blogging, tweeting, et cetera, about it if you're interested in what's going on there live. June 12th would be the day to keep an eye open and follow along. And then our tip of the week is actually 8 tips of the week, courtesy of Zoe, who's written a piece called Helping Protect Your Company from a Cyber Attack, 8 Tips for Human Resources Professionals and In-House Employment Council. We won't go through all 8 of them. Suffice it to say, all 8 of them are certainly things that people should be doing in connection with keeping their businesses safe, conducting background checks. We we talked a bit on the show today about the need for caution in sleuthing around about your potential employees. But certainly, as Zoe pointed out already during the show today, you're going to want to know if they're out there doing things that might make them untrustworthy, for example, would not be good to your cybersecurity. What else, Zoe? I thought this was really fascinating, the particular phishing emails that people have been getting hit with. Hundreds of businesses have been hit with a phishing email that asked them, purporting to be coming from the company's CEO, asking for the organization's W-2 forms in response to the request. What do you think is the best way to train employees to recognize what is phishing and what is not?
Yeah, that's such a great question, and it's really hard because employees are dealing with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of emails every day, and they're in a hurry to get through them. And so asking employees, you know, to really carefully look at the email address for each one and you know, take a look and see if it's, you know, seems suspicious is a burden for them and something that they'd rather not do, and of course makes business less efficient. I do think that you know, providing some general training on what to look for, you know, I think particularly like misspellings and grammatical errors, because a lot of times these hackers are not native English speakers. You know, so if you get an email, you know, saying, you know, I want your W-2 form now, I'll give me all or something like that, you know, I think you should be a little suspicious. I think another thing that's really helpful is having a fake phishing email campaign in your company. So sending out a bunch of these after you've conducted some training and seeing who bites on it and then giving them some additional training. A lot of companies do that now because there have been so many ransomware attacks and the vector of attack has been phishing emails. So I think a company would be foolish actually not to do that.
Yeah, that's actually a great idea because certainly if employees know that they're going to be subjected to more training if they fall for the bait, they're going to be extra careful. Other question I had for you on the back to the point of background checks. What do you think companies should be looking for in someone's background that might indicate that this employee might make the company vulnerable to cyber attack?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a good question in part because background checks are incredibly heavily regulated. Mm-hmm. So there are at least 4 laws major laws that impose a lot of restrictions on how you conduct background checks. Mm-hmm. So you have to very kind of carefully vet your background check program against those laws. So I guess my first point is, you know, not to kind of willy-nilly be starting a background check program without being pretty careful about compliance. Mm-hmm. But as far as, issues to be looking for, I had a case recently where it turned out that this guy who took some information from the company had previously been convicted for identity theft. Right. So, that's definitely one to look out for.
Yeah.
that's a pretty obvious one. I think various forms of crimes that, you know, just show theft in various forms, clearly a lack of, you know, maybe some sort of may hint at some sort of financial issues and, lack of respect for other people's property.
Very good. Thank you so much, Zoe. And thank you for joining us today. It was great having this conversation with you.
Yeah, really great to join you all. I really enjoyed our talk. Lots of interesting points covered. So thank you.
Our pleasure. Is there anything going on with Littler Mendelsohn or your office in Denver or anything in your practice or otherwise that you want to let people know about before we go ahead and sign off?
So the firm is really getting into, robots in a big way. That's, the next frontier of the employment context. I think, already we're working with robots in some form or another, and that's just going to increase. So we have published or should be publishing soon a book about robots, particularly in the employment context. And I wrote a chapter on privacy issues related to that. So I think that's a helpful resource for people who are, bringing robots or automation in some form into the workplace and thinking about how to do it.
Mm. Cool. That's still great. Forthcoming, right? It's not available now?
Yes, I believe it hasn't come out yet.
Okay, let me know when that comes out. I'd be anxious to read it.
Sorry, a future resource.
Yes, we'll let people know. Wonderful. Mike, did you have a question?
Nope. No questions.
Thought I heard you chiming in there. Great. Great chatting with you again today, too. How's everything going in Seattle?
Everything is going great. The sun is shining and it's very nice out. So what more can we ask for?
Not too much. Not much at all as we start June here. Perfect state of affairs. And Matt, it's been really great chatting with you, too. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much, and thanks, Zoe. You were great to have on. I do want to put a quick plug in because we talked about freedom of speech, but everyone should go out and read Abrams versus United States. It was just a great dissent by Holmes 100 years ago almost that got us where we are with freedom of speech. So that's my plug.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. I've got my weekend reading assignment then.
Yes.
100-year-old dissents for 500, Alex. some of the best ones were written a long time ago. We do this show every single week on Friday. Well, not every single week, except for the weeks when we don't do the show. But most Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. We love to get together and have you join us if you can join us live. That's a fun thing to do. You can jump into IRC with us and play along live. Don't worry about it. If you can't, head on over to twit.tv/twill and all of our shows are there for you to enjoy at your leisure on your device of choice. Instructions about managing your viewing of This Week in Law are right there for you. You can listen audio, video, wherever, whenever. We're just happy that you do join us however you do. And we're really, really thrilled to get your suggestions about things that you've spotted in your travels in the online and offline world that you think we'd like to discuss on the show. Please do get in touch with us between the shows about that. You can reach me. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Matt is MattC at twit.tv. And Mike is Mike at twit.tv. So send us an email, find us on Twitter or Facebook, and let us know what's on your mind. Let us know what you thought about what we did discuss and what you think we left out and what we should discuss on future shows. We love hearing from you. Love your ideas about guests as well who we should invite on the show. It's really, really helpful. In fact, it's so helpful that we couldn't do the show without you guys. Thank you so much for all your support of the show. It's great getting together with you every week, and we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Until then, take care.